When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary with Minky Couture. Luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.
Coming up on this week's show, the Sega and Nintendo war is back on.
A new powerful Amiga lands.
And we go inside the world of Eurocom with Kev Harrison.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every week with our sponsor, our good friends at Bitmap Books. Now, have you seen their latest book? We actually did an episode all about this a few weeks back. 50 indie games that changed the world. Exploring the incredible world of those games that may be flying under the radar a little bit and are made outside of that typical AAA studio. Covering 50 massive games, including pixelated classics like Shovel Knight to Dead Cells, Super Meat Boy Limbo, and lots more as well, weighing in at a massive 450 pages. You can order your copy right now and check out the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And with our friends at Replay Events, who in just a couple of weeks from now are bringing back the UK's most popular retro gaming event, Play Expo, back in Blackpool on the weekend of the 4th and 5th of October. And of course, you can expect traders, arcades, pinball machines, computers, consoles, and talks with industry legends. We'll tell you who's already confirmed very soon, but you can get your ticket right now and see the full lineup at playexpoblackpool.com. And welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 499, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to this week's show. I can't believe it is the last time an episode number is going to start with a four. Last one of the 400s, boys. Next week, 500 episodes of this podcast.
I don't know how we've made it. I don't know if we've all haven't killed each other. 500 episodes.
So we're doing it virtually now. Yeah, we're not in the same room.
I've just been plotting the whole time. I'm waiting for the 500 to come, and then my plan will come to fruition.
You're going to unleash all your next week. But, thank you so much as well for all your good luck and congratulations messages. I did mention last week that we basically want to have a bit of a party, don't we? Because we think it's worth celebrating 500 episodes of the show. So we want you to get involved. Now, we've had some great messages so far. So if you'd like to leave us one, we're going to play as many as we can on next week's podcast. It could be maybe a memory of the show. We've had a few of those. A few people have talked about their favourite guests. And a lot of people have just left us, you know, basically congratulations messages. It can be short or long as you want. But we do have a little page on our website where you can leave an audio message. Really simple from there. You don't have to sign up or anything. Do it from your phone. Or you can leave us a video message on there as well, linked to our Discord, which is probably the easiest place to do that. So you've got a couple of days, because we're actually going to be doing episode 500 this Sunday. So please get your messages in. All the details on the front page of the retrohour.com. Little button you can click there and get your message. Get your voice heard on episode 500 of the show. Now, we're actually going to be recording episode 500 a bit earlier than we normally do, because we're going to be doing a live stream of the episode for our patrons on Sunday night.
Yeah, so we usually do a patrons hangout, but we decided why not record the 500th episode with our patrons watching, which is going to be really tough. Because I'm just going to get the giggles. And, a lot of the guests have come on the show and they see how the background works. And we've had a few patrons actually come on the news section as well. So they're going to see or warts and all. And I think it's a really good idea, though. Yeah, I think it should be good fun to have, you know, everybody watching. And of course, we're going to do a bit of like interaction as well and some behind the scenes stuff as well with the patrons.
Yes, if you'd like to join us for that, become a patron. Make sure that we can continue past episode 500. Really helps us out. All the details at theretrohour.com. You can sign up there and join us for the live 500th episode celebrations happening this Sunday night from 8 p.m. UK time. Got an incredible guest as well to join us for episode 500, the first of a two-parter. So we'll tell you more about that next week. But of course, we have got a guest on this week's show as well. And this week, we're going to be going inside the world of a legendary British company who are based just down the road from us, weren't they? We're going to be talking about Eurocom.
Yes, yes, they're based in Derby.
Yeah. Founded back in 1988. We actually had Chris Shrigley on the show, didn't we, back in the day? Episode,
I remember that one, yeah.
Yeah, 178 that was, quite a while ago. Who was one of the founders of Eurocom. They worked on some massive licensed games, including porting arcade games to home consoles, a few original properties ahead as well, like Magician, Machine Hunter, Sphinx and the Cursed Mummy. Company shut down back in 2012, but today we're going to be joined by Kev Harrison, who was one of the lead designers at Eurocom and worked on some of their huge licensed properties, including James Bond 007 Nightfire. You fan of that? You loved the Bond games back in the day, didn't you, Joe?
You know what? I'm not a big Bond fan of like the films, but I always really enjoyed the games. A lot of love for the games, and a lot of people obviously say, you know, GoldenEye, best Bond game, etc. But when I was a teenager, my mate Matt got Nightfire for PS2. Oh man, we played that game to death. Like literally, it feels like years. It was probably months, but.
Yeah.
All we used to all go around to his house and we'd all hood around the PlayStation 2 and play multiplayer on that. It was so good. I think we probably played that as much as we played GoldenEye, you know, a few years before. So I'm really looking forward to hearing all about that and its development. But he also did Predator, Concrete Jungle.
Yeah.
Which, you know, some people love it, some people not so keen. If you've not heard of that one, go look it up on YouTube, etc.
It's a bit of a cult game now, really, isn't it, that game?
I was about to say, real cult following on that one. Because obviously Predator at the time hadn't been wasn't too much in the media, I guess. Like, you had the Alien vs. Predator film, which wasn't people's favourite film, but it was Predator Concrete Jungle. Like I say, some people absolutely loved it.
I think everything with Predator has like a cult following. I used to collect comics and, you know, the Predator comics, Predator vs. you know, everybody was just such a huge thing.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, there wasn't a lot of it, I guess, other than comics in the, you know, kind of early to mid 2000s. So Concrete Jungle filled part of that void there. But he also did some Star Wars games, including Star Wars, The Clone Wars. So I think really it's just a lot of big licensed games, you know, and they're kind of like in my kind of teenage years, actually, which is really cool.
I love the fact that he worked on Lightsaber Duels, which was a Star Wars game for the Wii. So, I mean, you know, dealing with those motion controls, which actually, you know, you're talking about lightsabers. I've not played that game, and I imagine that would work quite well.
It's a bit safer than having a real lightsaber in your living room. So, yeah.
Still break your telly with a Wiimote, though. And it's done. So, we're going to be hearing about some of those huge licensed games that he worked on as well. And, obviously, the dealings that go on working with the big movie studios as well. So some great stories from inside Eurocom as well, which is a company I think doesn't get enough attention. You know, they were a huge name in British gaming back in the day. So we'll find out a bit more about that and what the atmosphere was like there and the culture. So Kev Harrison is our special guest. He's on the show in around half an hour from now. But first bit of the podcast, that's when we have a bit of a chat about what's been happening over the last week in the world of retro gaming and technology. And this was quite surprising to see. Seems that Sega are getting a bit sassy against their old rival Nintendo again.
Yeah, I loved this. I saw this as Slopes actually posted it on social media. So I hadn't
Slopes Gamer in fame, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I hadn't actually seen this anywhere else other than him posting it. So I wonder if... it's an advert, basically. I wonder if you know, anybody's seen this on YouTube or anything like that and in their adverts. But yeah, so obviously in the early 90s, Sega and Nintendo had that huge rivalry, you know, Sega Genesis in North America, Sega Mega Drive over here, taking that big, big, big portion of the West, Sega were, from Nintendo. A lot of it down to blast processing, you know. Just throwing out some...
what was blast processing, Joe?
Well, blast processing was their attempt at doing something to take on Mode 7, wasn't it? So the console could do something different.
Basically, it was a...
Well, I mean, as having a gimmick, you know.
Yeah, it was a coined kind of like term gimmick that, like, you know, the Mega Drive was faster than Nintendo and then faster than Super Nintendo. Basically, the term came from, it was something to do with like forcing pixels through the chipset quicker. They discovered and they called it blast processing or something like that. But they famously did the advert where they strapped a Sega Mega Drive to the back of a, it wasn't an F1 car, what was it? It was like one of those kind of very, very long, fast cars, really famous in America. I can't remember what they're called. And then they put Mario Kart in a Super Nintendo, didn't they, on the back of like a clapped out motorhome, and basically say, and then it's got Sonic the Hedgehog, I think it's Sonic 2 on the Sega version. It's just like, Nintendo doesn't have blast processing, and it just zooms off, doesn't it? And it just shows how slow Super Mario Kart is compared to Sonic. Which to
drag racing,
fair,
that's what you're thinking of, wasn't it?
Drag racing, that's it. I couldn't remember what it was called. You know, the advert worked, like, but they've done it again. Earlier this month, they've released the same advert, basically. They've remade it, haven't they? Right down to, and I can't believe they've done it, Mario Kart. They show off Mario Kart World on the Switch 2 strapped to the back of a motorhome on an old TV. And then they've put the new Sonic Racing game, which is, what was it? What's it called? You're a fan of
Crossworlds.
Sonic Racing Crossworlds, which looks like it's the latest in the kind of like Sonic transformed racing games. And they've done the exact same advert, basically saying, look what Sonic can do. Like, yeah, you know, you can, what is it? It says something along the lines of like, oh yeah, and that.
Well, do you want to hear it? I've got a clip.
Yeah, go on.
Have a listen.
Yeah.
Here you go.
We all know that kart racing game. It's great. We don't need to show it to you. But what if you can blast through and race on a whole nother level? What if you could warp across different dimensions? Fully customize and build out your machine and compete head-to-head across different platforms. Or what if you want to roam around on the open road?
Wait for it.
Sega!
There you go.
That was the bit I was going to say was my favourite part.
Yeah, but you're right. I mean, it's crazy that they're basically, I mean, it's tongue-in-cheek, isn't it? And it's obviously Mario Kart. You can see it's not all that pixelated. But it's interesting that kind of they're taking aim at Nintendo in their marketing again now.
It's kind of for you lot, though, isn't it? It's for us older people. You know, no kids are going to understand blast processing or blast processing. I barely understand it. It's a marketing term from what I've seen. And there's a bit of like, you know, CPU difference. But this was the time of the Sega versus Nintendo wars. And they're gone, you know, they're no longer like making any hardware, Sega. So they kind of got to go back to that time, put something out, get a bit of nostalgia in there. I do remember all that silliness with Atari do the math as well, and
the edgy 90s marketing.
And Amigas, it would take ages for Sega to be this good or something like that. You know, it's all that kind of marketing.
That's Amiga all over for me.
what was it? It will take Sega ages to be this good or something. For the CD32, I remember.
That's funny. I think the irony of it is that Sonic Racing Crossworlds is coming out on Switch and Switch 2.
Yeah. As a lot of people have pointed out, that they might be taking the mickey out of Nintendo, but it's running on their console. So.
Yeah. obviously, you know, then, you know, I don't want to use the word partners as in like, you know, they're partners in the company, but, you know, they obviously work together because Sega have been releasing games on Nintendo hardware now for what, 24 years or something like that.
Yeah, they've got no choice, have they?
So. They've got no choice, but I wonder if they asked Nintendo first or if they've just gone with it and don't care. Like, but it's funny to see. And Ravi's completely right. It's aimed at us. It's not aimed at like my kids or anything like that. Yeah. But interestingly, you're a bigger fan of the Sonic Racing games than you are the Mario Kart games, aren't you?
Yeah, I do. I've always loved those games. It's I mean, don't get me wrong, I love a bit of Mario Kart 8 on the Switch is awesome, and the Wii U, Ravi. I forget the Wii U. But yeah, I mean, I've always loved the Sonic Racing games. I think they're a great series, and yeah, I mean, obviously very similar to Mario Kart, but I think it's, you know, it's got some beautiful graphics and. Sound design as well. My mate Ross Tregenza, he actually worked on some of the Sonic Racing games doing the music. So yeah, I'm hyped for this. I think, you know, the Sonic Racing games are always, again, I mean, you know, Sega does kind of go big on nostalgia. Well, you can tell by the marketing there. So they're always great games if you like those kind of.
Yeah, I'm interested to see the new titles that are going to be coming out as well, like the new Crazy Taxi and stuff and Jet Set Radio. Can't wait to see those.
Yeah, so if you want to check out that trailer, very, very reminiscent of Sega's marketing back in the day. Nice to bring back the Sega Scream as well. Good to hear that, wasn't it? Yeah.
You know, that's, you know what? I never saw any Sega adverts on TV. I don't know.
What?
I saw like the British companies like, get your Sega games from blah, blah, you know, all those kind of adverts. But I didn't see any ones from Sega itself. Maybe they remember the them in America.
The Cyber Razor cut, that was legendary here back in the 90s.
You've just reminded me, my mum used to always do the Sega to me, but my dad would do the Sega.
I was watching the BBC. I think I was deprived of adverts. That was
probably.
And there was do me a favor, plug me into a Sega. I remember that as well. Back in the early 90s. But yeah, the Cyber Razor cut though, that was huge. And then in the Saturn adverts as well, I remember those. They were really freaky.
They were weird.
Games Master, I remember seeing a few adverts around that kind of advertising slot.
Yeah, Ravi was drunk for most of the 90s, I imagine. Can't remember that time.
I was like 10.
Exactly. So, it was great to see this edgy marketing coming back again from Sega. So, hype for the new game. And if you want to check out that trailer, I'll link it in this week's show notes. Now, this is an interesting story and something that I'm quite pleased to see. Now, this is a game that was cancelled 40 years ago by Elite, who were a veteran British publisher, who I believe are still going today, aren't they, Elite? Been around for many years. And they did a Scooby-Doo game back in the day. Now, this, for me, this story is quite close to home because I did get this game that they released on my Commodore Plus 4. And if you guys, if you Google Commodore Plus 4 Scooby-Doo and just have a look at the video, not the unreleased one that comes up first. It also came out on the Spectrum as well. Because as a kid, I remember seeing that in a shop, and bearing in mind, I've talked about it in the podcast before, when I had a Plus 4, I got it years after it was released, and had to basically, ask them, have you got any Plus 4 games in? They'd nip out the back and get a dusty old crate and bring it out. And I remember seeing Scooby-Doo and loved the cartoon. Thought, wow, this game's going to be amazing. And it was one of the worst platform games I ever played. I remember that. You know, I've talked about getting Rise of the Robots for Christmas 1995 and being disappointed. But I think Scooby-Doo on the Commodore Plus 4 from Elite Systems was my first gaming heartbreak. So this story, though, is quite interesting. So it turns out the game that they released, that rather crap platformer, wasn't what they were intending to do. Instead, it was going to be basically a game that would have really pushed the technical boundaries of the Spectrum, the Commodore 64, and the Amstrad CPC, a game called Scooby-Doo in the Castle Mystery that was basically like an interactive cartoon.
I guess like kind of Dragon's Lair playing like that, little animation sequences, but also on 8-bit machines, which is the insane thing. A lot like long before Laserdisc or anything like that, or even the ability to do the animations, like, Dragon's Lair was quite good on the Amiga, from what I remember. But looking at these screenshots, it looks amazing. Really, really, really good. And I like to see some of the kind of moving elements because, I've not seen a game, that an 8-bit one that's been aimed for, the Spectrum, C64 and the Amstrad as well back then, that looks so good.
Well, basically, they're saying it's an interactive cartoon. And it did get some reports back in the day. Sinclair User covered it. They said the game was visually stunning, but a shambles in terms of gameplay. So then it ended up getting shelved at like the 24th hour, basically saying that, the hardware on those machines, particularly the Spectrum 48K, couldn't handle all the animations, the sound and the code all at the same time. So what they ended up doing is they obviously had the Scooby-Doo license. They knew that would be a big seller to kids. So they shelved this and just made that crap platform game that I was talking about before that came out in late 1986. But it turns out this game was pretty much finished back then. There are still some prototypes and demo code that exists. And turns out the guys who originally worked on this, so it's John Harrison, who's the artist and co-designer, Richard Wilcox, co-designer and programmer. Andy Williams, who was another programmer.
So, some good names to be on board there.
Definitely. Yeah. Huge names from back in the 80s home micro scene here in Britain. Well, apparently they want to get this game finished. So they're saying, obviously, retro is a massive thing now. And a lot of people are really interested in kind of lost titles. So they reckon this will be a good opportunity to revive and finish and remaster, restore and release the game.
Well, there's plenty of C64 different types of new machine out there. And you've got the Spectrum next as well. Lots of Spectrum clones. I reckon, yeah, they'd have a good little market for this. And if there's already existing things, I'm just thinking of an 8-bit Shaggy. Like, if they could do that would be really good.
Shaggy?
There you go. See, if you want to sample Joe for that, you've got our permission to put him in the game. But yeah, so they're saying that, yeah, they would like to target the original 8-bit home micros. I think, as you said then, Ravi, the Switch would be a good platform for this, wouldn't it? Because it would have the capability to run it. You're not going to be running into that the wall that they did trying to cram it into the 48K Spectrum. They're also saying they'd like to do it on modern systems like the Switch and the PlayStation, Xbox, and maybe even smartphones as well and the PC.
Did you mean the next then? Sorry.
Yeah, the Spectrum next, it would be, I think if they ported it to that, obviously it'd have the capability, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
To run it. So that'd be a great platform, like, you know, the C64 Ultimate as well. Definitely not short of new retro systems at the moment that this could run on. So they're basically looking for prospective publishers to come along and help them complete it. Now, the major stumbling block is the Scooby-Doo license from Hanna-Barbera, which is now owned by Warner Brothers. As you imagine, that license,
greatest,
that lapsed.
Cartoon artists in the world. Yeah. And now that's gone into Warner Brothers. Yeah.
Yeah. So that lapsed 40 years ago, obviously. So it's going to be, but I think that's going to be the hardest bit. They've basically got to get the license back again in order to release this. So they're looking, I imagine, for someone who's got a bit of experience kind of dealing with these big companies. So
yeah, or even in the legal department, just so you know, we're not going to stamp on the sales of your old Scooby platformer, which they're probably not selling anymore. You know, it's possible that they could just get permission to put it out there.
So yeah, I mean, it, again, though, it's a franchise that, you know, is timeless, really, isn't it? It always gets new generations coming on board. And I think it would be nice. I mean, we always talk about it on the podcast when projects like this, particularly something so ambitious, kind of gets abandoned. It is always nice when it finally gets finishing out there. But as someone comments on this article here, they definitely do need to get Hanna-Barbera on board as well, because nobody wants an off-brand version of this, because then what's the point? It's got to be a Scooby-Doo game, hasn't it? It's got to be that original one finished off, I think, for people to care about it. But sounds interesting. Maybe we should get the guys from Elite on. I think that'd be a good story to get from them.
Yeah, so, definitely.
Yeah, so we'll keep an eye on that story. If you want to read more about that, I'll link that in the show notes. Now, a system that is definitely not short of new games in recent years is the Sega Dreamcast. And there is a new game coming up very soon for that. That actually looks really ambitious, this game. A game called Mute Crimson.
Yeah, so this is Mute Crimson DC, because Mute Crimson did come out on Steam last year.
Mm.
This looks really awesome. It's very like Super Meat Boy meets Prince of Persia, is the only way I can describe it. It's like those really nice 2D platformer graphics, but you're a little ninja. And I really like the art style of this. It's in black and white, the game, isn't it?
Yeah.
But the violence, the blood, the gore, and everything you kind of have to dodge, like any projectiles or like energy beams or bullets or anything, is all in red as well. From what I can see in the trailer, it's like a one hit and you're dead kind of game. So very reminiscent of Super Meat Boy. Like
very frustrating.
Very frustrating, yeah. Playing through like a hallway over and over again, dodging, you know, everything and attacking everything in, you know, one go kind of thing. And huge kind of Mega Man-esque bosses, which, you know, you have these big fights with, and it looks as if you get hit once, that's it, you're done. So yeah. Very, very difficult game, but looks absolutely fantastic. But it is being ported to the Dreamcast, which is great to see. Obviously, the Dreamcast always getting, you know, love, and so many games coming out all the time. But it's completely for free. So it's by Ice Lizard Games, and they've put this out for free. And basically, it is just a ROM that you download and burn to a disc. which I think is fantastic.
Now, the saying is obviously a fully unofficial game, not endorsed by Sega, as anything that comes out in the Dreamcast these days is. Mm-hmm. But it looks like a lot of work's gone into this. I mean, you know, I'm very pleased they're putting it out there for free, but I think, you know, it adds to the Dreamcast library, definitely. They could have charged for this, I think, though. I would have paid for this.
Yeah, you would have thought they could have, you know, maybe kickstarted it or something. Like, the chiptune, like, soundtrack is really, really good. Like I say, I think the art style and the graphics are fantastic. Obviously, graphically, it's, you know, kind of, I wouldn't say 16-bit. Mm. You know, it probably belongs on, it looks like the PlayStation could probably run this, you know, kind of like 30-bit, 32-bit kind of style.
So it's been out since 2024, and then you can buy it as well. So you can get it on Steam and Windows, and that's like £12, £79. So there is like a price in there as well, and a separate soundtrack. But the thing about this one is, I think they're giving it away free because it's a bit more limited than the main one. So they said in order to fit it into the Dreamcast, they had to make some compromises. So like the particle count and Sticky Blood has kind of been reduced. They've also taken the bitrate of the audio down. So that really clear audio, they've had to take it down to support, you know, the Dreamcast audio. There's no rumble support, and also the rewind function, which, you know, Dan Wood would be using all the time.
I'd be using it on this game as well.
The rewind function is not actually going to be available in the Dreamcast one. So they're going to do like a lot more checkpoints in easy mode. But I can imagine that's quite hard to implement in that as well. But this looks like, you know, if this could be downgraded, I guess it can be downgraded for other systems as well. And we could see ports coming out for different old retro consoles.
I do like the fact they put an easy mode in there as well, which they do say is optional, but I imagine even you'd be playing this on easy mode, Joe, if it's kind of
this game looks fantastic, but it does look very tough.
Awesome to see new Dreamcast games. I love the look of this as well, like I said, that kind of black, white and red look.
Yeah, and they're saying that they're putting it out free so it can reach more players and add something to the Dreamcast library, which is really nice.
Yeah, so that's available now on that itch page. If you want to give it a download and burn it to a disc or on your optical drive emulator, I imagine. Now, this story's been big in the Amiga world over the last week. The new Amiga, well, it's not Amiga, is it? This is the Apollo A6000, which they're saying promises to pick up basically where Commodore left off 30 years ago. Now, we should probably give a bit of background on what the vampire is, Ravi, for the non-hardcore Amiga aficionados amongst us. Explain what the vampire is to Joe.
Oh my God, give me a task.
If it helps, I don't care.
I'll pretend you're interested.
Joe, you've got £1,000 just spare hanging around.
£1,000,
yeah. So what the vampire is years ago we had accelerators, which were like these older things that you plug into the Amiga, you get a big speed up and everything, but people stopped making them. So they decided to make one in FPGA years ago. Me and Dan had them on our machines, and you click them in, you get a bit of a speed up, and then it turned into its own system. And that was called the Apollo standalone system. And it was quite expensive, but it did a lot of like kind of continuations of what people wanted on the Amiga. So Super AGA, which was like a new graphics mode, came out, and there's also support for this Maggie 3D and all this extra kind of stuff that's like if they'd, you know, done more blast processing on the Mega Drive, or they'd increased, you know, like they'd gone past the Dreamcast and they'd added some extra stuff, you know, like the plans that Commodore and Amiga had. They've implemented some of them. It's quite a high-end system. It's quite advanced. And what they've done is they've got a standalone machine, but now they've put it inside a case as well. And
with a nice keyboard.
A nice keyboard in there, and a case looks like the old Amiga 600 case here. Mm. It looks all right. I thought the Apollo standalone was quite expensive on its own, which was around, £500. Pounds, and then with this case, we're kind of hitting 1,000.
Yeah,
or around €1,000. I don't quite know why the case is about 500. You know, cause
well, apparently this is a more. It's not simply the. So the standalone one was the Vampire V4, wasn't it? So yes. Apparently this is not just one of those dumped into a case. It's actually a more powerful system.
So, yeah, it's very niche. It's very niche. It's with, and to be fair, that small production run that they have run of them, I think, I don't know how many they were offering. But
there's 40.
Okay, yeah. 40. So they've sold those. Yeah, and guess if there's a demand for it, we're probably going to see some at some of the Amiga shows. But this is like the most souped up, high-end, random kind of obscure machine. It's not going to change the world, but people that like it and people that love that kind of thing will totally lap this up. And hopefully there'll be some more development. There'll be, you know, stuff that gets ported onto the Amiga as well. Yeah, what do you think, Dan?
Well, that's what you actually touched on a really good point there. And that's kind of always been my, not problem, but kind of concern with these kind of things. I mean, I do have one of the old Vampires. So the released one, God, going back over a decade ago now, didn't they, called the Vampire V2, which basically fit inside the Amiga 600, the old Commodore machine.
Yeah, I had one of those as well, yeah.
Yeah, I've still got it. I mean, it doesn't get a lot of use, but basically you clip it over the CPU and the old Amiga, it would, you know, hence the name Vampire, it would kind of suck the soul of the Amiga and take over. And it was great because it would give you, you know, nice 24-bit graphics, 60 million colours. You could run it in, you know, film HDTV, run it in 1080p. And this machine here, the Apollo A6000, that's got 2 gigabytes of RAM. It's got USB-C on there as well, analog audio connectors. They've got mechanical keyboard with Cherry MX switches. Very cool system, but the problem is it's I just didn't see software taking advantage of it. And I think it's what you said, Ravi. It's the fact that because these are very small runs of systems, they haven't got huge user bases. So it's kind of like, you know, you've got the hardware, but you haven't got software that takes advantage of it.
It relies on a few developers. But also there's one thing that no one ever, ever mentions about Vampire that I think they need to shout about a lot more. It is compatible with the STs. It runs...
Atari ST, yeah.
Yeah, it runs Atari ST software as well as some Falcon software there. So, you know, it's kind of like a bit of a souped up Atari ST as well. And I think there's a very funny video. I think it was... Neil RMC and it's you. Somebody on YouTube had the button pressed down but on accident on their keyboard, which launched it into Atari mode, and they didn't know about it, and they were like, why have I got this Atari?
but that sounds hilarious.
What's happening?
So I mean, and one thing we should mention is the one they've sold recently, like there's only 40 units of this. Whether they're going to do more or not, I'm not 100% sure, but apparently they're going to be showing some of them at the Amiga 40 event in Germany in a couple of weeks' time, where you and I are both going to be at.
Well, that was where they launched the V4. I remember that, and I remember sitting there and think they had 40 as well, because it was like, you know, Amiga 40 or 34 or whichever Amiga event it was, and they sold them all straight away.
Yeah,
and you know, it was pretty amazing to see actually that, you know, I couldn't drop this much money on a system, but, you know, some people do.
Yeah, 100%. It's definitely got a market. I mean, I've got, you know, Omega 65 that, again, is victim to the same kind of thing. You know, not many people own them, so there's not much software for them. You've got to kind of be content with or learn to program yourself and, you know, become a developer for it, which would make sense if you've got the skills. But, yeah, and we should also point out it's a 3D printed case that they've got this in. I'm kind of thinking for £1,000, you know, I get that it's a really small run. But I've seen a lot of people saying, you know, for a grand, they'd expect a proper molded case, not a 3D printed one. Which, yeah, it looks like high quality 3D printing, but looking when you zoom
like
in,
it's high res stuff, isn't it? So I've done stuff
speckled.
3D printing, and it's got a lot better.
Yeah,
yeah. But also, I always find these things, photos are really hard to represent what it's like. You know, if you go and touch it and feel it in real life, and then, you know, hopefully see it, then you might change your mind. With things, I've particularly seen that with displays and monitors and stuff, you know, seeing them in real life, you're like, wow, that looks totally different to what I thought it did originally online. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it in person when we head out to the Amiga 40 show in Germany in a couple of weeks' time. And I think it's cool that, you know, obviously there's stuff like the Pi Storm that you can get now for your Amiga where you put a Raspberry Pi in as an accelerator, which is a lot cheaper than something like this. Because when the Vampires first came out, they were quite affordable, weren't they? I think my B2 was about 150 quid.
That was the thing also, all of this stuff like the Pi Storm and using Raspberry Pis and using smaller, kind of cheaper bits of hardware, Terrible Fire as well and stuff, that wasn't available back then. So, you know, it was a kind of forefront in going into that area, but then the market's expanded so much and prices reduced and stuff. So, it's interesting.
Yeah, so those Founders Editions have all sold out. They went, I think, on day one, didn't they, really quickly. But fingers crossed there will be some more available if you are interested. So a6000.net is a website if you want to keep an eye on that. I think Joe's just come back into the room. I think he's been out for a takeaway.
I'm here. Don't worry.
We'll continue now.
And you had mentioned that we're going to Amiga Germany as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That should be interesting. I'm going to be hosting a talk on stage there, so should be good fun.
They rubbed you into working, did they, Ravi?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be happening in Montelgladbach in Germany in a couple of weeks' time. So I'll put a link in the show notes for tickets for that as well. Going to be a massive event, isn't it?
Mönchengladbach.
Okay, I always say it wrong, don't I?
I probably said it completely wrong. We're going to get corrected by all our German listeners now.
What are the dates for that? 17th and 18th of October?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's going to be huge. And I know Amiga Bill's coming over if you watch him. Bunch of crew from America, so it's going to be a massive Amiga celebration for the 40th year of the Amiga. So if you're coming along to that, come say hi. And I think this is awesome. Now, one of my all-time favourite games is getting a D-Make. We do like talking about D-Makes, don't we? This is where games kind of get ported to platforms that couldn't previously support them. So that often means, you know, downgrading the graphics and the sound. And this is Golden Axe. That is coming to the Atari 2600.
Yo, I heard your retro game wants to get even more retro.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, in terms of Atari 2600 graphics, I think this looks pretty good.
This looks... when I first saw this, I was like, ooh. But then I was like, wait, it's the Atari 2600.
Yeah.
So this is a Brazilian developer who's, I was going to say downgrading there, who was demaking this, and he's basing it off the Master System version of Golden Axe. So it's not the arcade version or the Mega Drive version, it's the Master System version. Obviously in Brazil, Master System was huge, you know, so, and he says that's the version of it he loves, etc. So I went and had a quick look at the Master System version, because I'm obviously familiar with the Mega Drive one, and you know what, for a Master System game, I think it looks really good. So this does look quite far apart. However, with it being an Atari 2600 game, as far as Atari games go, I think it looks fantastic.
Yeah.
Took me a minute to realize there's a screenshot of when you use your magic. And I was like, what is that? And I kind of had to look at it for a second. I was like, oh, it's Axe Battler, like using his magic, like, because it goes black and white when he does it and it kind of like silhouettes him, which I thought was really cool once I realized what it was. But yeah, in terms of like, actually having it running, etc., you know, I kind of forget sometimes that some Atari games were just Pong,
yeah.
You know, with nothing else on the screen, whereas this has got like full backgrounds of sky and ground and trees and enemies, and a life
multiple enemies on screen at once, which I think is quite impressive. There's actually screenshots with two or three on there, which I imagine is quite demanding for a 26.
Yeah, exactly. He's also working on, in the original arcade version, when you defeated enemies, they turned to clay rather than like flashing away. So he says, you know, that was missing in all the ports. Other than this version, he's going to try and implement that into this game as well, which, you know, I think is even crazier that he's going to try and leave, you know, the dead bodies kind of like still on the screen as you walk around fighting other enemies and walking away. So really, really impressive. You know, just had to kind of remind myself of what this is running on. Like, you know, it's not going to look like the Master System, but damn, it looks a hell of a lot better than some Atari games I've played.
And there is a thread on Atari Age that I'll link up in the show notes with some more screenshots, and you can download demos of it as well. He's been working on this for about a year. We put out a new version of it a couple of weeks ago and some more screenshots. And there is one which is like where you select the magic and it's got Axe Battler stood there. And he's kind of, the way he's downgraded that actually looks quite hilarious. Yeah. If you look at it, it's basically turning it into ASCII art, pretty much. But yeah, I think, yeah, top marks for effort, though. I mean, again, it's not something I imagine could have ever worked on the Atari 2600. I haven't downloaded this to play it, but I am quite curious to see kind of how well it runs. But I think just even having some kind of, you know, combat in a game with multiple enemies on the 2600, particularly with the elements in there like magic and stuff as well, I think is a great effort. So if you want to keep an eye on that. The title of it is Tarik, A Golden Axe Story. So still a work in progress. So you can download that if you want to check out the progress of that port so far. I'll link that and, of course, all the rest of the stories in this week's show notes.
Mönchengladbach.
Ravi's been listening to Google Translate for the last few minutes. Now, Amiga Germany's not the only thing coming up in October. It seems like October's a pretty busy time for retro gaming events right now. It used to be, didn't it, that when summer finished, that was it for the year, but plenty going on over the next few weeks. Before we head over to Germany, there is the massive, in fact, the UK's biggest retro games expo, Play Expo, back at the Norlympia Exhibition Centre on the weekend of the 4th and 5th of October. Play Expo Blackpool is going to be back on, thanks to our sponsor, our friends at Replay Events, who've kindly sponsored this week's episode. And we've been good friends with Andy and the team at Replay Events for well over a decade now. Love working with these guys. And if you haven't made the pilgrimage, which I think is the right word to use, isn't it, to Play Expo before, and you live in the UK, you've got to get yourself there. For people that haven't made it, Ravi, what can you expect from Play Expo?
Yeah, so Play Expo, it's just ram-packed weekend of retro fun, you know. They've got a great gaming market there. You can get some bargains. Pinball machines as well, and the original arcades. A huge amount of arcades, actually. You know, there's always queues to get on them. There's always machines that, you know, are all set free to play. So you can play on them all weekend, which is fantastic. People absolutely love coming and playing some of those old ones. There's a big setup of indie studios. They're going to have 15 indie studios there. And they've also got a lot of guests. It's good to see the Vectrex Mini is actually going to be shown for the first time. So absolutely love to see that. But the guests this year, oh my God, like the lineup is absolutely insane. So you've got RJ Michael there. And, you know, RJ Michael, of course, the Amiga, but also the Atari Lynx as well. And
the 3DO.
3DO, yeah. Matt Householder as well. Got Jeff Minter, one of the best British video game designers ever. We've got Charles Cecil as well from Revolution Software, joined with Tony Warriner. And then John Romero, the creator of Doom. And he's doing Beat the Creator, so you can actually play the father of FPSs and see if you can beat him, which I think is going to be quite a tough challenge.
Yeah. Can you imagine that, a Doom tournament with John Romero?
With the guy who made the levels.
And,
I think he knows them well.
Yeah, so it's if you want to check those guests out, they're always incredible. I'll make Paul Drury, I know he's doing some of the panels there this year as well. A retro gamer, and of course, a Christmas quiz. What was that, Paul? On? And I just love the traders area as well. It's like, you know, picked up some real bargains there over the years as well. And it's nice to actually get your hands on some of that you're buying, isn't it? And kind of see the condition of it. And you'd have to pay stuff like postage and all that.
Yeah, I like the LAN as well, because they have a lot of, you know, people able to sit down and play together. And there's not many places where you go and you can get like 15 people on the same game and play together in that old style.
Yeah, and the socialising aspect of it is always amazing.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
Yeah, like-minded people, you always end up in a bar having a chat about video games till the early hours, normally, don't we? So, an incredible event. It is coming up in a couple of weeks' time. Get your tickets right now. All roads lead to Blackpool for Play Expo 2025, happening on the 4th and 5th of October. Get your tickets at playexpoblackpool.com, and I'll put that in this week's show notes. And a big thank you to Replay Events for their continued support of the podcast. So, quick reminder, we'd love your messages for episode 500 of the show. If you can get them in by this coming Sunday, we're going to be recording it on Sunday 28th of September at 8 p.m. UK time. So you've got the weekend to get us your messages. We'd really appreciate that. Video and audio as well. Link to do those are on our website, theretrohour.com. And we will see you next week. Get well rested, boys. Ready for episode 500 of the show. And next, going to be catching up with this week's special guest, going inside the world of Eurocom, some huge licensed games. Kev Harrison is next on the Retro Hour podcast. the Retro Hour podcast, and it's time to welcome on this week's very special guest. Now, today we're going to be joined by a veteran game designer who's worked on some huge franchises over the years, including James Bond 007, some Star Wars games as well, Hellboy, and spent a good few years at the legendary British UK studio Eurocom. And we're going to get some stories about some of the games he worked on, some hopefully inside little tales of what working at Eurocom was like back in the day as well. So let's welcome on Kev Harrison. How's it going, Kev?
Hey, thanks for having me. Yeah, veteran, I suppose that's probably one of the a positive of getting old, I suppose, isn't it? I'm seasoned, I know what I'm doing. So, yeah, I suppose we'll find out.
Well, let's find out where it all started. I mean, we like to kind of go back to roots when we have a guest on. I mean, what first got you into video games then? Do you kind of remember your earliest memory?
I don't know. For a long time, so when I grew up, I was very poor, very, very, very poor. So I didn't have any consoles or anything like that, but I knew someone who had like a Dragon 32. I remember playing Chucky Egg on that. I had a friend who had a Vectrex, which was awesome, you know, and you could customize it with different sheets of plastic to make the graphics, you know, more red or green or whatever. And I remember as a kid, I went... this is a minute older, actually, but I remember going to, you know, we used to have like computer shops, like before the days of Amigas, and there was like these huge like Archimedes things that only like businesses had. And I remember going in like every day in the school holidays and playing a bit more of the Monkey Island demo they had kind of running in the background. But I think I had an auntie who got into a very serious car accident and got a payout, and she got a NES with like tons of games, and I go and stay with them. She was in the wheelchair for like a year and it was horrendous. But for me, I got, she had like loads of games back in the days when no one had any, you know, you had like one game and Mario, you know, there was Metal Gear and there was Mario 2, which I remember completing and staying up like all night for 24 hours and, you know, playing it. And you know, the blisters everyone's to complain about with the, on your thumbs just to get that. And I live like in the kind of centre of Derby, so I'd be in town all the time in very, very sketchy arcades that were grim. And I know that Stranger Things had this kind of really cool, you know, retro vibe in arcades, but in reality, it was grim, you know, it was really, really seedy.
Yeah, the British arcades weren't like that back in the day. Yeah, that glamour.
Going to places like Taxi Ranks and things like that and Paul Hall to play arcade games. And I won't go there now. Like, you know, my kids were going to those places, but you know, that's where you got, you know, your games. But I did have, when I was younger, a Acorn Electron, and I think my mum got that for me because she thought I'd be a programmer, you know, and it was all that kind of stuff. And I did copy about two or three pages of code to get one Space Invader, and I'm like, what is this? This was like, you know, half a day's work for one Space Invader, and I never got on with it. So I kind of gravitated towards game design. So I wasn't good at games because I was super skilled. I was kind of good because I could work out the kind of meta of how it all works, that kind of thing. And that kind of makes sense, you know, like predictability and things like that. You'd see patterns and, you know, there'd be budgets and things like that. So, back in those days, everyone, you know, I had the Acorn Electron and friends had Spectrums and Amstrad and things like that. So you'd kind of go around and do the round and play all the games as much as possible.
I think the Electron's a good choice as well, because obviously it was really a cut down BBC Micro, wasn't it? And I imagine, you know, you probably ended up using BBC Micros at school like we all did.
But remember at school, though, we didn't have any learning. Everyone just wanted to play games. You know, no one had any interest in kind of programming and things like that. And I remember, the Acorn Electron, there were some wild kind of like budget games. They're just rip-offs, just cheap rip-offs. And specifically, there's a game called Escape from Moonbase Alpha that I played loads, and it's a big influence, but the design was just random, and it had like Daleks in it, and the Hulk was in it, and all sorts of weird stuff that was like, you know, a copyright nightmare. But it was great, you know, it was just like a wild west of just random games that were completely unfair and things like that, and, you know, impossible to beat. But that's what you spent kind of your winters doing when it was cold and dark.
I think it's great that you mentioned the arcades, because we had a Nottingham arcade gaming scene as well, and that was quite sketchy. There were like amusement arcades, and those were also one that weren't strictly an arcade. They were also kind of a gambling place that you would go in, and people would be smoking in there as well, and like some dodgy characters. I wonder, were there any arcades that you really wanted to like have on a home system or really influenced you?
I don't know. Because I suppose the kind of thing about the arcade was they'd change them every couple of weeks, so it's completely random. So it was almost awesome that you'd go in, there'd be something new and exciting and things like that. So obviously I remember when Street Fighter came out for, like, you know, the home systems, because, you know, I've put a lot of money in Street Fighter 2 because it was amazing. And then the thousands of rip-offs that came after it and things like that, like World Heroes and all sorts, and Mortal Kombat. And all, you know, there was a record shop way ahead in Derby, and that kind of had like the best arcades, like the really, really kind of cool ones. And I remember they had the Crude Busters, and that was like every other kind of beat 'em up, but with an extra dimension that you could like grab everything and do these extra moves and like a whole new dimension with an extra button. And it was great. But I think my favorite go-to was would have been Final Fight. And I still think Final Fight is like a really kind of pure fighting game. And it's really, really good. It's really, really clever. It's extremely difficult because they were, and there's no one could complete that on like 10p back in the day. I think like 1,000 credits because it's just hard, but it's still brilliant. I still play it to this day. And I think what they did with the characters was like almost like early stage of like an RPG, you know, that the characters behaved and acted with different kind of, you know, abilities and things. And yeah, you know, I've always loved that, always.
Well, at Home Systems as well, they had a very different set of games and designs. Were there any that inspired you, you know, strategy or platform?
I don't know. So one of the things is, you know, kind of growing up, and then things were really expensive. You just played whatever you had. So someone bought you a game, you were like, oh, man, I've got a new game. But it was crap, you know, and you're like, well, that's it now. Like, this is, you know, like nowadays when you get, you know, like things like Game Pass, you can try a game out for 10 minutes, you get kind of bored of it, so you try another one. But, you know, when you got a game, you were locked in. That was it. That was it. That's all you got for your birthday. So I played a lot of things, and it's weird. Like, I prefer personally, like, I don't know, like RPG-ish type things, like role-playing type things. I like horror stuff.
Yeah.
But depends, when I'm working on something, I can do a massive deep dive. And because I'm working on it, I want to see how it works. I want to see what makes it tick and, you know, why does like the target audience love it, or why didn't they love it, or what went wrong. So I'll absolutely play whatever to death, you know, whatever genre. But I suppose growing up, it was... Whatever you could borrow off your mates. You know, I remember playing like Wonder Boy, and then that was rock hard. And I remember, I suppose a big influence was Spider-Man on the Master System, because it did loads with it. It had like an RPG type effect where you could make money by taking photos, and it had like alternate endings and hidden things. And to me, that was like next level. That was a massive eye opener. Like, it was a labour of love. Like, so whoever made that, they put all these extra things in. They were clearly, like, you know, Spider-Man fans and things like that. So I remember that being a quite a big influence. And I finished that multiple times. And if you got the super secret ending, you've got this kind of picture of Spider-Man, like a Todd McFarlane in, you know, very pixelated. But it was the greatest thing ever. You know, when you were a kid, it was amazing.
Well, you mentioned about, you know, obviously designing those rudimentary titles on the Acorn Electron. And then, obviously, you know, started gaming at a very early age. What was the transition from being a gamer then to actually wanting to make it a career then? What kind of happened there?
Sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night, like, sweating that I think I'm good at this job, you know, a designer, and I'm an average cook, and my car mechanic skills and my DIY is shocking. So it's really weird that I kind of fell into this job, and, you know, and I'm very, very grateful for it. It was weird. I went to see Games Master live when it was at the NEC years and years and years ago. Nice. And I remember they had the Sega boss, and you went downstairs and played like a random sum of games, and you went upstairs and played like a new game, and it was Sonic 2, right? And I knew that there was basically this, they said that you had to get the highest score. I guess the highest score wins. And I knew that time beats, like, you know, 100 points for killing an enemy, 10 points per ring, but you get like 100 points per second. And I knew that in Sonic 1 that you could like go into a ball and just whip through the whole level without touching anything on level 1. So I took a gamble and did that again. So I knew how the game worked without doing it, kind of thing. And I won a T-shirt. I still got it, a T-shirt with Gilius Sunderhead from Golden Axe. And once I caught one of my kids like wearing my T-shirt, I'm like, no, not that one. All the others you can steal, but not that one kind of thing. So that had a kind of an effect. I'm like, well, hang on. So I do know how games work. And I remember when I was 18, something like that, there was a advertising for game tester roles at Eurocom. But back then, you see, it was classed as not a real job. You know, this would have been, I don't know, I started like a week before my, I'd been like 18, 19. No, 18. And I've been 18 because I started there a week before my 19th birthday. And it was weird. Like, I thought, why not? I'm trying for all these different jobs. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I had a really good part-time job. I was doing stuff, but, you know, I needed a career. So I went for that. And then I think it was like 3 months later, someone got back to me and said, hey, have an interview to be here. In QA, and I'm like, okay, but I kind of had an understanding how games work, and that kind of whole Sega thing on the Sega bus can gave me the confidence to go, hang on, I do think I know what I'm doing somewhat, and then I interviewed for a QA job, and I didn't like it at first, the QA job, but it was my foot in the door, because it was only because some of the games that were being made, they weren't efficient, like as in like modular enough, and I was like, hang on, if you change some of these things, so I got the opportunity to like. In the first 6 months to kind of test out things and try some like game designs on paper and things like that. And then I got my kind of first gig on Duke Nukem 64. So I worked on that as a designer, and I basically lived at work. You know, you just live at work and was doing late nights and sleeping in the office and things like that. But back then when I was younger, I could do those kind of things. But also, it took sometimes like 40 minutes to do like a whole build. Like if you played Quake at lunchtime on your system, you had to kind of reboot the whole thing because the cache kind of built up, if you did a full build, it took like 40 minutes sometimes. So you had to test something. And so even though it was long hours, a lot of that time wasn't just, nose to the, keyboard and just like plowing through things. So, I was a big Duke fan anyway, and I think design-wise, it's absolute genius. It's really, really good. So having to kind of like piggyback that and adjust it, and it was very good training wheels. So I got to create my own things, but, adjust and adapt for the Nintendo and 64 and also kind of make it our own. So that was really, really good. So it was a weird transition. And, originally I just took a punt at a game design, a QA job.
Were you aware that there were like a game scene going on in Derby with you had IDOS there as well?
No, not really. It was only when I kind of started there that it kind of blew up. That all of a sudden, people had a Tomb Raider and things like that. It was, I don't know, I was too busy being a tow rag at 18, doing, going out and things like that. And I wasn't aware of the scene. And, I'd always been, a massive games fan, but again, back in those days, I mean, I'd imagine most of your listeners kind of can get on board with this, but back in those days it wasn't cool to be a nerd. If you like games or D&D or comics or that, you were a target. Harry Potter came along and normalized having glasses. I used to have these big thick glasses. I was born like really blind. I wear lenses now, but I had these huge glasses, and again you're hanging around this really sketchy pools and things. If anyone looked like a target, that's going to give up their money, like real easy. It was me, trying to play these arcade games and things like that. So no, I wasn't really aware, but you didn't kind of go shouting from the rooftops. You know what I mean? There was a comic shop in Derby that was really, really cool, but kind of like, nerds kind of snuck in under the cover of night and out again, so you wouldn't get beaten up on the way past.
Well, Duke Nukem's obviously a huge first title to work on. What are the memories have you got of that then? I mean, were you a Duke fan before you you got to work?
So I was playing Duke. It was great, and one of the cool things about working in game dev then, there wasn't really much internet, but there's easy access to like LANs. So everyone's playing co-op games and multiplayer games. And I was pretty good at Duke. And you can see the fact that each level is kind of linear with a few split paths, but then the whole thing loops around itself and becomes like a multiplayer level. And also one of the things that people don't talk about enough is that whole first level on Duke as a multiplayer game has really, really good audio. So if you listen carefully, you can hear where people are. Mm. It's very, very clever. Yeah. I don't know if that was on purpose or not, but it's like layers of genius kind of thing. So and my kind of first outing, you know, we were very, very, it was a really small team. We're like 8 people, I think, you know, like a core team, like eight people, 6 people. I'm not sure, but it was, yeah, it was not very many of us. We basically just adapted things and turned them in, you know, try to do it justice. And I love doing my level. I look back at them now, I'm like, oh, these are nowhere near as good as the, you know, originals. But, you know, we tried to like theme them and kind of tell stories in multiplayer. So we had lots of slidey things and cool like stepping stones and things that open and close and weird stuff. It was, you know, as you're playing multiplayer, that is, so, you know, lots of stuff that, you know, make it kind of like dynamic. But no, it was really, really cool. It was really, really good. I was very, very lucky. You know, most things I've worked on, I've been extremely lucky because it's all things I've loved. And there's some things they're not my kind of, you know, go-to or whatever. I'm totally fine with that. You know, it's when you're making a game, you're never making a game for you. You know, you're a fan. You know, you have to look at the, you know, target audience and create a specific game and for marketing and things like that. So you do have to take a bit of a step back, but that doesn't mean it's any less fun. You know, it's really, really cool. So yeah, I was very, very lucky with Duke. Although it was weird because we saw him as like a Bruce Campbell type of character where he was kind of funny and say these kind of stupid things and he'd get the girls, you know, the kind of 90s bikini girls at the end and things like that. But everyone else saw him on the published side as like deadly serious, like he was a real hero. And you're like, well, hang on, that's odd, you know. It's so yeah, to us he was like pretty much Bruce Campbell, you know, that kind of character in Evil Dead where he might get something wrong, but he wins the day anyway, that kind of thing. But no, they were like all deadly serious. So, but apart from that, you know, it was, well, everyone's on the same page and it was really, really cool to work on.
Was there any like censorship as well? Because you're going from, you know, quite a racy, yeah, raunchy PC game onto a Nintendo
yeah,
console.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. And, yeah. And this was like, you know, the back end of the 90s where everything was kind of like, you know, extreme and lots of swearing and violence for violence sake and things like that. So everyone's like, you know, oh, you know, you can't censor it, you can't do that. It's like, look, no one really cares. Like, it's okay. It's fine. You know what I mean? It's the very low quality sprites of women gyrating in 3 frames. It doesn't make a difference. Do you know what I mean? It's all good. Yes. Yeah, so we did, and they were overly cautious. We, you know, we put a load of like Simpsons gags and things like that. So, you know, we kind of got the humor, put reference to things in. We had to take a load out. There's a casino and it's called the Money Pit. Something like that. No, was it called the, I can't remember, but basically, yeah, it was like, oh yeah, this is too close to the Tom Hanks film Money Pit. I'm like, no one's going to put 2 and 2 together there and things like that. But yeah, it was weird. It was weird. But again, everyone got kind of busy with that. So they cared about, you know, these like sprites and these kind of like crap jokes and one liners. Whereas the kind of gameplay, we could just get on with it and do what we wanted. And yeah. I did one night create, there's one of the ships has a level in space of the ship that flies past, and I made that into the Fiery Phoenix from Battle of the Planets, and I spent ages doing it, and then someone hated it and goes, no, we're going to change that, I don't get it. So I took it out and I regret that ever since, because I like a good, yeah, Battle of the Planets homage in there, because I thought that was ideal.
I was wondering then, because, you know, having contracts with like Nintendo and companies like that, what was it like? Was it massively professional at Eurocom, or was it quite a chilled out culture there?
It was weird. It's a bit of both, because it was different. So, like, you know, I've seen several companies kind of go from small handful of people making games together, you know, very passionate about it, turned to, you know, big companies. So when there was 3 of us that started on the same day, and we were like 22, 23 and 24, you know, employee numbers kind of thing. So it was very, very small. And then I was there for 9.5 years, and there was like, it was very creative. It was very, very supportive. It was very, very cool. You know, my office always looked like a bedroom with toys and graphic novels and stuff and reference things everywhere. And we were working. Everyone was working like all the time, because, you know, the more time you put into it, the better it is. And it's like, you know, everyone wants to make everything as perfect as possible, you know, from the artists to designers to coders, everyone wants to do as much as possible. So everyone would like buy lots of things. I remember people had like offices full of Pokemon and like airsoft guns and things like that. So it was kind of chilled out. It's really bizarre, because it is kind of chilled out because it's creative, you know, and some days you can absolutely just do you know, 3 days work in a single day because you're just on fire. And other days, you know, things go wrong, you're trying to fix things or whatever. And then whenever I've done anything out of game dev, you see a lot of people, you know, a lot of companies are like, oh, you know, we're agile with it. Like no one is anywhere near as agile as game dev, because things just change all the time and things evolve and you do create all these rules and pipelines and things like that. And I'm a big fan of that. You know, I like, I kind of lean onto the side of like narrative design and stuff like that. And I've done some really wacky kind of cool things some ideas that are like, well, we'll try this out. It might work, but you have to have this kind of like solid base, you know, this kind of foundation of everything being modular and everything being, you know, like, you know, tech savvy and just safe. And then you can do like weird, crazy, cool things with like, you know, once you've got these kind of chess pieces that you have, you can come out with some really weird and wonderful gambits to make levels and experiences for people. So yeah, it's cool. And the thing with Eurocon, because we're all there, and I think sometimes like the engine, you'd hear about, you know, these other game engines that people are using and, you know, importing things from Max and Maya and things like that. And everyone's been like moaning about, oh, the engine doesn't do this. It was all their own in-house tools at Eurocon. And then when I went to like somewhere else, you know, in other places, you were like, hang on, that was really good. You know, yes, some things weren't as ideal, but the things that you could do with that engine, you know, and the turnaround, it was really good. Really, really good. So it's an extremely good tech team. You know, it was cool, you know. So the things they could do with AI and level design and things like that was really good, you know. And like every day you were learning something new. And I still believe that to this day, that no matter what, you should always be learning, whether it's new or things evolve and new trends or whatever, just better things. So yeah, it was Eurocon had a really, really good set of tools, and everything was Euro. So Euro land, Euro this, Euro that. But you get to every other company and they have the same thing. It's exactly the same thing. It was great. It was great. And just basically, I think we're all very lucky to have, you know, access to all those kind of tools and support, because yeah, it was great. Really, really good.
Another big game for Eurocon in the year 2000, James Bond, The World Is Not Enough, on the N64. I mean, have you got any memories of that then? What was kind of what was happening at Eurocon around the time that came out? And did you have any involvement on that title?
Yeah, I was one of the designers on that. It was okay. The World Is Not Enough. So basically, we just finished Duke. We did Duke 64, then Duke Zero Hour. And Duke Zero Hour was good, but kind of humbling, because we've done a game before. We go like, oh, we know what we're doing now. And we made this game, and very much in the kind of old school Amiga vein, where it was just rock hard. It was just brutal and punishing. And then when it came out, it did all right. But it was like, oh, hang on, that was really hard. You know, it was difficult. And maybe we should, you know, that was the whole team or whatever, but I know a couple of us, you know, me and the designer were like, yeah, that was really hard. We could have made that easier. And you know, this is where we start to look at more of, you know, the target audience and things like that. And
it was always going to be compared to GoldenEye as well, wasn't it?
Yeah. So we did Duke, and then basically as GoldenEye came out, and I don't want to sound like sour grapes, but I was never in love with GoldenEye, but mainly because I was playing PC games. Now, PC games were sprites, so as the design of the levels was really, really, really in-depth, whereas I thought it was much more linear. And there's nothing wrong with it. And basically, you know, I'm not saying it's bad or anything like that. I'm just saying that I think things took a step back, but it was a really, it was an accessible game for a console for the first time. Like, you know, you could play with your parents or whatever, and then the people got it. So then we got The World Is Not Enough, which I thought was awesome. It was great. You know, this is cool. But it was like, no, it cannot be like GoldenEye for various reasons. I'm like, okay, cool. And we got these scripts. And they came in like a brown, again, this is like pre, I think maybe the internet was just kind of like, there was no broadband.
Still dial-up, you know, back then, yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, it was, you know, so we got these kind of brown, big brown envelopes that had like, you know, shoelace kind of like written things like wrapped around them to unwind them all and everything. And you got these scripts out, and it felt very special and important. And basically it was like the film scripts. And so that was a big eye opener. And a few of us, you know, we worked our butts off to try and recreate these things scene for scene. And then like literally a week later, it'd go, all right, this has changed now. The script's changed. I'm like, all right, so this level doesn't make any sense. And the people at Wing Bond at Danjack were very, very, very supportive. They were really cool. But they had all these rules. Like, we had bomb chases, someone into the London Underground. We had hit a bomb there in one of the toilets. So we put it in the women's toilets because there was more cubicles. And they're like, no, Bond wouldn't do that. I'm like, but the fate of the free world at stake. You know, no, Bond wouldn't do it. And we were like, this is really stupid. But it was a storytelling thing, which I didn't know at the time. So it was like, no, it's not that Bond wouldn't do that. These things don't exist. It's just like you don't see characters go to the toilet or no one says goodbye on the phone and things like that. It doesn't work. So it's like, right, now I get you. So that was really good, like learning about kind of like characterization and kind of storytelling. So what we did was we took all the big stunts because we knew that they were like literally locked in and they cost a fortune and they couldn't change. So we kind of built like an almost director's cut. Around, so basically in the film, Bond turns up somewhere and sees a meeting, but in our game, it showed you getting dropped off and you're fighting your way to that meeting, things like that. So that way, if things change, we could just change a little bits and bobs at the end and kind of polish it, and no matter what, until like the last minute, if need be. But we created this kind of like really cool like director's cut of the film. And then... when we did multiplayer, because we're all massive multiplayer fans, like I mentioned, we were all playing these like LAN games, and we'd have these huge Quake games and Team Fortress, which I think was out at the time. And we'd play, it was the Quake Team Fortress where it originally was, not the Half-Life one.
Yes.
And then we'd all play Team Fortress characters against like AI, Quake monsters and things like that. And it was really cool. So when we did the multiplayer, you know, we try to give all the characters like special abilities and powers, and that was a lot of fun. That was really, really cool. So, yeah, it was good. It was really enjoyed that. We kind of really pushed the engine to its limits and did everything. And I was looking at some videos actually recently, and it got a lot of love back then, and it was cool. And I still see people talking about it now. But like the acting in it and where the characters, it's a lot drankier than I remember. So in my head, it was this absolute masterpiece and was beautiful and not as like cubish and Roblox like, less polys than I remember. But no, it was good. Working the World Is Not Enough was very, very cool. You know, it was a good experience.
I think we often get rose-tinted graphics in our memory, don't we, with these old systems. But I mean, that said, I mean, I know it was praised, you know, technically for, you know, frame rates and long draw distances, you know, for the N64. And obviously by the time you did the next Bond game, Nightfire, by then we're on new platforms. You know, the Xbox was out by then, PlayStation 2. Also came out on the PC and the Mac as well. I mean, how did kind of those lessons from working on The World Is Not Enough inform like the next Bond game then that you worked on, and having new systems? I mean, I guess you had a lot more capability there to push those systems to the limit.
Yeah, it was good. So one of the kind of main programmers, designers that I work with, my friend Aaron, and we're still friends to this day, me and him would do things very differently. Our influences, we're friends, but we do things very differently. But I've always felt like our levels would gel, even though we wouldn't kind of discuss what we're doing, or we would discuss it, but not in detail. Right, I've got these levels, you've got those levels. It felt like we were playing the same game, you know, and it was very, very cool. So we always knew what we wanted, and we knew, like, Rongo, hey, we want a character that does this. We go, no, we want a way to spawn characters, you know, in a certain way so we can get loads of use out of it. And he'd run ideas by me, and I'd do the same with him, and then we would, you know, create different kind of like ways to spawn characters or cover nodes and things like that. So we had, like, you know, what's classed as smart terrain, where, you know, enemies would like hide behind walls and things like that, and you know, based on your location. It's what kind of Gears of War did much, much later. It's much more obvious in Gears of War, but, you know, what we're trying to do is, one of the things for us is when you enter an area and it's a first-person shooter, you doesn't have to play out in the same linear fashion. You know, if you go left, this happens, you go right, that happens, all that kind of stuff. It's very, very cool. So I remember we were like chomping the bit to go, all right, I've got a new engine, we're going to do like Nightfire, you're going to do all these extra cool things. But then everyone had the same idea. So we were thinking, yeah, we can have more enemies than ever before. But everyone else was like, oh, we want more, you know, high detail characters. We want teeth. We want all this kind of business. So it was still cool, but like everything was ramped up. Everything was completely ramped up in that game. And EA obviously involved. On the world is not enough, and we had, you know, someone from EA come over and help us out, and, you know, give us pointers and make sure everything was going to, you know, the kind of the bigger plan. But then Nightfire, there was a huge amount of people involved, you know, from EA, and sometimes they wouldn't all kind of agree with each other as well, and they would like argue, and you were like, oh, I don't know. It's like my parents are arguing. I don't know what to do. And like the idea of Bond was a big one. So, you know, what was James Bond going to be like? And Dan Jack, who owned Bond, obviously Daniel Craig wasn't, you know, in the picture then. It was still Pierce Brosnan. But they were leaning towards what Bond should be is a lot more how you see Daniel Craig. You know what I mean? It's a lot less comedy, but still witty and dry and a bit more savage. And you do see that in some of the later Bond films with Pierce Brosnan, you know, like he kind of picks up an ashtray, like wrecks someone with it. And, you know, like, that's a bit naughty kind of thing. So they wanted that. And then we were like, sure, this makes sense. But then someone else wanted that. We should be more like Sean Connery. Like, well, that's just being smooth, but that doesn't come across in gameplay. But then someone else wanted Roger Moore. So we had our animator Daz, he was a very, 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 very good animator. And he was an ex-boxer for Ireland, like under 16 or something, in like, the Olympics. So he knew how to throw a punch. So he did this really cool, like, punch animation that, like, you know, it felt really meaty. You think you'd knock someone out. And they were like, no, change it to, like, a Roger Moore chop. And we're like, look, you do know that Austin Powers is a thing now, right? We can't be good judo chopping people. But that was the kind of thing with Nightfire. You know, a lot of people, a lot of cooks getting involved in the broth kind of thing. And it was changes all the time and things like that. And people couldn't decide.
A lot harder. A lot of different elements in there that kind of broke up the gameplay as well. So it wasn't just a standard kind of FPS, go around and kill everything. There was, you know, hacking elements in there, like lots of exploration. What was that like, and were there any features that were kind of dropped from there?
I thought that the story in Nightfire, I thought, was really, really, and this is my opinion, you know, the story in Nightfire was really, really good, and there wasn't enough gadgets. So we wanted to put more, you know, we did more gadgets, but then the story kept changing all the time. And then the gadgets they're very expensive to make. So we made sure that they were in more than once, and there were like fun things to do, and a lot of games, you still get it now, where you get like some kind of weird interaction, like a QuickTime event.
Yeah.
I'm a firm believer in I shouldn't be watching the QuickTime event. I should be watching what's happening to the QuickTime event. But normally they're so difficult that I'm too busy watching the buttons or trying to like line something up or do something. It's like, nah, it should be fun. It should be relaxing. It should be the reward of doing these kind of things. So we did make sure that we put all those things in, because I think there's a demand for X amount of weapons in the game and no gadgets, things like that. But we made sure that, you know, they wanted to put them all in. And then there was this, you know, the notorious shaver, the kind of razor thing. I don't know if you saw that, but we were told like very, very late in development, we had to put this kind of like, I think it was a Philips shaver, but it squirted foam, and you could then have a wet shave with a electric razor. But like, what do we do with this? And we couldn't make it explode. Because that'd be bad, right? But like, what do you do? Do you get like a henchman in the headlock and like shave his eyebrows off or something? And it was like, what do we do with this? So I think it was some kind of hacking device in the end. But there was a lot of things, you know, in Bond, in Nightfire, where like we weren't involved. We were just kind of told that this is happening. Like this character has changed, or there's a new character being added. And even though, you know, it was like, right, there's going to be driving things, missions. And we're like, oh, okay, all right. And we never really saw them until they were done. So it was like two separate studios completely. There wasn't much communication between the two. Nothing wrong with that, you know. It might have been nicer. But again, saying that, we're all flat out at all times anyway. So, it was just done a bit differently, but obviously that was a big thing for EA at the time, and that's when they kind of chucked all the money in it and threw different studios at it, which I suppose now is a lot more common practice where you have multiple studios all working on the same thing, you know. Yeah. But when I've seen it, it's coordinated, but I suppose that was one of the first, so it was probably early days for them.
Well, another huge franchise that Eurocom worked on, they kind of became the kings of these massive franchises in the 2000s, was a Predator. And Predator Concrete Jungle as well, which was same name as the Dark Horse comic. Completely different plot on that, though, of course. I mean, what do you remember from that? Because I heard that it was quite different in the initial stages. I mean, did that kind of change much from the original plan of that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was going to be like a GTA style game. So all the tech for it was built in like a GTA kind of thing. And for us, what we wanted to do was give you that kind of Predator experience. I mean, with everything we kind of worked on, and if I say anything like, you know, that I've done, again, it was never just me. It was always, you know, a team, and I would bounce ideas of other people, never supported, things like that. But one thing we wanted to do was, there's like a level in Bond. I mean, wanted to, bits where you kind of schmoozed as Bond, so you got that real Bond experience. You felt like James Bond, you know. And when we did a Predator, we wanted you to feel like the Predator, you know, and feel powerful. And so we did things like you were almost unstoppable, and you go invisible, but a puddle could mess you up, and the cold, you know, would wreck you. And the idea was, there would be a city, and you'd have the city in the two different time zones, and then the city would evolve and evolve and evolve, and then it would stop evolving, and you'd, yeah, because you've searched it all, and then the season would change, and the game got harder as the seasons continued, because in Predator 1 and 2, it's all about, there's a massive heat wave. And then as we were kind of starting development, they said, hey, there's a new AVP film coming out. We're like, oh, okay, cool. It's like, yeah, it's set in the Arctic. I'm like, what about that thing where the Predator doesn't like cold? And like, no, that's gone now. I'm like, oh, okay, brilliant. So, and then there was an issue where I think it was Crazy Taxi and not Simpsons Hit and Run. It was Simpsons
Road Rage.
The other one. Yeah. And I think there was like a legal case where they used the pointer in the game as Simpsons use a finger and they use a triangle. But they got sued over that. So literally 2/3, possibly even more through development, they said change everything and make it, you know, a like a level-based game. And it wasn't designed for that, you know, and we did it and it was okay. But I think one of the major things, and we're doing too much. We had, you know, I was doing insane amounts of hours, you know, I was like living at work and everyone was getting ill and things like that. And I do really love the game. But when it came out, it was a bit all over the place and games were getting more expensive to make and there was less games coming out. Because, you know, previously, every month there'd be like a ton of games, you know, and now it wasn't. It was like big titles like we see, you know, in kind of modern era. And you know, they cost a fortune and therefore had to, you know, make all the money back and everything. And Predator was a bit of a struggle and it was difficult. It was a hard game to make, but it was really, really enjoyable. And, you know, the team were great and everything was about it was great. And the AVP website and podcast and team, they got in touch and looked into it all, and there's loads of massive fans saying, oh, it was like, you know, yeah. The
great, it's got a cult following, you know, hasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I never knew until literally this year. I'm like, what the hell? You know, and it was extremely wholesome. And it's like, yeah, that bit where this happened, I'm like, yeah, you know, I had to fight for that. It was really, really cool. And, but yeah, really, really enjoyed working on it. And it's been 2 decades, but yeah, I'm seeing like all this love come for it. And it's amazing. And they also, what, about 5-6 years ago, randomly made a Predator figure based off the character in the game. And I'm like, what? Who what? Like other people?
That must be amazing,
this?
Though. I know back then, like 20 years ago, you know, I've looked at some of the reviews like IGN and stuff who were quite critical of the game. I imagine, yeah. You know, for the reasons you said that the initial vision's not what it ended up becoming. So knowing that it has got this like community around it who've really embraced it and still love it 20 years later, that must be a bit of validation for all the hard work you put into it.
Oh yeah, 100%. 100%. Like that was amazing to hear. Like it was never... You know, it was like done and dusted, and I still, you know, remember it fondly. But you know, we got paid and we did a job, and it was cool and everything, and that's it. And then all of a sudden, we saw this figure come out 6 years ago, and we're like, "How? What's all this about?" And then all of a sudden, someone asked me about something, the review of it, and I kind of went onto YouTube and, oh yeah, I worked on this, you know. And for a year, people were asking me questions in the comments section of this YouTube video, and every now and again, I get like a comment, you know, an email notification saying, hey, someone's asked you. So I'd answer them all and it was cool. And then someone got in touch and said, hey, do you want to, you know, talk about it? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. So one of my good friends, I went to Australia with him when we finished Eurocon, and he's still over there. So we caught up, and someone else who worked on it, and they're over in Europe now as well. And then we all got together and it was really cool. And then the AVP guys got in touch. I'm like, oh, right, so you saw us on this other thing. They're like, no, never seen that. I'm like, what are the chances? And it's been really weird. Like this year, I've had a couple of different people wanting to talk about Bond and two different things about Predator. And then the other day, someone spoke about Hellboy. And I'm like, what? Like, what's it? And it's great, the fact that we have, you know, all this love. And because we do try and create these, like I mentioned, you know, experiences where it's not just a game with the character slapped on it, which me is very common. And I see why people do it, or it's time and, you know, whatever. It's difficult. But that's something, you know, always strive to go, what can this game do that no other game can, you know, what can we get away with? What, you know, what sells it?
That's notorious in the kind of world of, you know, licensed video games.
Yeah.
Just, you know, slapping a character on it, putting something out, doesn't really relate to it. And not having that like passion there. Yeah.
Yeah, the
Amiga
days,
even post
the Ocean Games,
you know, some of the
and the same as, like, you know, like superhero films and game films, like, we know, like the first Mario film that had nothing to do with Mario, and you're like, yeah, and it was just a normal, you know what I mean? It was just like, and I remember reading like a lot of Batman, like crossovers, and Batman versus this and Batman versus that, or whatever. You know, this could be anybody. You just slap Batman on it. You know, this is a story about. And I remember Batman versus Predator, for instance, was pretty much like the same story. I think it was like an initial draft or something of like Predator 2. And it was very, very cool. And again, that was something that I think that kind of resonated, where we all tried to create this, you know, absolute experience. And with the Predator, it's difficult because you're like, is that Klingon? Like, they're very close for the whole honor thing and just being angry all the time. You're like, oh, okay.
I remember all those comics you had.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Judge Dredd versus Predator and Batman versus Predator.
Yeah.
It was such a huge thing with fans.
Yeah, yeah. It was like back then, you know, comics were like the big boom of like comics and everything. And yeah, it was awesome. So yeah, I've just been very lucky to work on these things.
Well, quite a few fans still ask about the Netgun as well. So, what's the story there, and why didn't it make the final cut?
It was just like when we fired the Netgun. I think it was awesome when you fire a Netgun and it sliced someone into like jibs, and it was great. And you know, we had lots of violence in that game. We spent, you know, a lot of attention to detail on the violence. Like when you break someone's head or break their spine, the noise has to be hollow, or is it like a snap and all this kind of stuff. But the Netgun, it just looked rubbish when it landed. And then we worked out you could grab someone instead. So the Predator, being slightly taller, we made him pretty huge. He was kind of pretty much based off, it, well, not influenced by the Capcom beat-em-up version. You know, the Capcom kind of beat-em-up, side-scrolling beat-em-up, like Final Fight of AVP.
Yeah.
The Predator in that, he's got a really long back. So you get these really cool like poses off him and things like that. So he was a lot like that, and less like a dude in a suit, which is, you know, obviously got to be the constraints of the film. And these giant hands, so we could have you grab someone and just pick them up and then slam them on and do things with them and just crush them. And it meant it was so much less hassle because you couldn't drop them, you killed them, and once you dropped them, they were dead. Whereas, you know, anything, especially back in those days, anything like physics and things like that, it would be a frame rate killer. And it was awesome and violent, but it looked kind of janky. And there's a few things janky in there, because again, I think we're doing too much, you know, spinning too many plates. But that was really janky if we, you know, got rid of it. But the crushing heads was just way cooler anyway.
Another massive franchise, you know, which has been a bit of a theme in your career. You got to work on Star Wars as well. You worked on lightsaber duels for the Wii. So
I did.
I'm interested to hear a bit about that. And I mean, obviously, it kind of feels like the Wii would be the perfect platform to do a lightsaber game on as well. So what have you got to consider when you're doing games for a motion control system? And how did you get involved in
this? That was like a highlight of my entire career. Like, the team was awesome. It's the only game like I've done in like 8 months. You know, we were a tight team. It was really, really good. They said that, hey, there's this new Star Wars thing coming out. It's called the Clone Wars. You know, do you want to, you know, work on it? I'm like, yeah, it's all good. And at the time, the Wii one-to-one kind of Wii remote thing was happening. I was like, oh yeah, one-to-one to be perfect. I'm like, well, it can't be, because we can never emulate your wrist. You know, it works on Wii Sports because you've just got a floating fist, and the chance of you just like put the lightsaber in your own face is going to be awful. You know what I mean? And we did see a prototype game while we were at LucasArts that used one-to-one. And it was kind of awful because I suppose it's like Just Dance, right? So in Just Dance, you look at the screen and you think you are doing these smooth moves, right? And you're hitting the beats and it looks cool. And that's experience, like karaoke in real life. You're having a great time and you're singing and you feel like you're on stage and everyone's loving it. If you see yourself, it's going to be shocking, right? It's going to be awful and completely embarrassing and you haven't got the rhythm, but it's a video game. We want to sell that fantasy. So that's what we're kind of aiming for. So it was really hard because we had to make the Wii work how you think it works, not how it actually worked. Because humans don't go right, you go left, right. When you jump, you don't go up in the air. You crouch slightly, then go in the air. So as you go up, you naturally... So that took loads of work. That took absolutely loads and loads of work. But we were very clear what our goals were, what game we were making, who it was for. And when it came out, I remember that's got one of some of the worst reviews I've ever had in any kind of game. It's like, there's no Luke Skywalker in it. Darth Vader's not in it. It looks like The Show and I hate The Show. You know, it's not one-to-one. You're like, look, it's never going to be one-to-one. That just doesn't work. Darth Vader's not in it because it's part of The Show and blah, blah, blah. So it got slated, but we designed it for kids. And then I remember one of the reviews we came through, I think it was Eurogame, an absolute kick in saying we hate it, we hate its face, we hate everything about it. I'm like, all right, everyone stay positive. And then we looked and we saw his videos on YouTube of all his kids playing it. And then again, like if you filmed yourself, you look weird playing it, but you thought you were being majestic. So we'd nailed that kind of Just Dance kind of feeling. It then went on to sell again and again and again and again. And, you know, we got two or three of his going, it's crap, it's for kids. And it's like, but kids love it. It was for kids. So I think it's one of the best-selling games, you know, I've ever worked on, saying how big the budget was and everything. And we nailed it. It was very, very proud of it. Very, very good. And then people grew to love the Clone Wars. And obviously this, you know, huge and epic and things like that. But at the start, people were like, oh, what's this? What's going on here?
It's always...
So, yeah, that was awesome.
Tough introducing anything new to the Star Wars world as well. So people love it so much. They're very passionate about it. I was wondering... how close did you work with LucasArts then to kind of
Really close. Like, they were dead sound. And we were still friends with some of those guys now. You know, they're really, really, really sound guys. And we worked together and I learned a lot about, big beats and basically trying to sell, like, ideas and gain people's trust to go, here's this really crazy idea and here's what we're going to do. And it was cool. That got me me and the other leads went to Skywalker Ranch and LucasArts in San Francisco as a bit of reward. We had all the meetings over there, and that was amazing. And then we got to work on a second game, and we got to wrote like an original story, which is like a no-no. Like you don't really write stories for stuff because everyone. This to show me and say, hey, they've created a new character. And it'd be like a Mandalorian in the company's colours or football team's colour or something. And people look at us like, well, we get thousands of these all the time. You know, this huge cast, can just not use one of those. So we weren't allowed to write a story. I ended up writing a story because to help piece them together. And then it actually got approved and Dave Filoni gave it like the thumbs up. And I met him a couple of times. He was a very, very nice guy, huge, you know, and he was really, really cool and very supportive. It was really good. It was just really, really, really good. And the fact that it was Star Wars and this thing you love as a kid, was, you know, as an adult as well, just made it even better, you know. So it was really cool. But that game never came out. It never saw light of day because things had to shift and we couldn't. So I think we were just out of pre-production and then it got canned. But it was cool. But, you know, that's not the first time that's happened. Mm. It's just games, you know. It is what it is.
We did touch on a few minutes ago that you worked on Hellboy. The Science of Evil, which obviously came out on PS3, 360 and the PSP as well. What memories have you got of working on that project then? And how did that differ across platforms?
Yeah, that was really good. I really enjoyed it. And when we finished it, it sat on a shelf for a year and didn't do anything. It basically sat there for a whole year because there was two different Konami offices and one closed down, and then they kind of went, well, Hellboy 2, the movie's coming out, so they kind of sat there. And so when the game came out, it was very, very dated. It also had this really, really super complex and detailed like co-op system, But I don't know if anyone ever played it in co-op. And the metagame wasn't as strong. But everyone who worked in that team was super talented. They've all gone to bigger and better things. It was very, very, very cool. I came along and I was doing more things like budgets and things like that. You know, I think when they first started, they were quite over budget with things. So I would take all these kind of zombie Nazis and go, right, let's take them apart and we can make three or four characters out of this. And it was still very, it was very kind of like system design, technical design or whatever, but it was a lot of fun doing it. And then I got to create two of the two DLC levels and they never saw light of day. They were never released. So a year later, when Konami released the game, the DLC never came out. So everyone's got it. One of them was Hellboy fighting these kind of were-coyotes in this like an original story that I did. And another one had Loster Johnson, one of the Hellboy characters. And I had to send it to Guillermo del Toro and Mike Mignola for approval. And they loved it, which was awesome. I didn't get to meet them. But they said, oh, great, this is really cool. And I'm like, oh, yeah, cheers. And at the time, they were in discussion with them making like, the Hellboy animated films. And he goes, oh, yeah, we'll get Bruce involved because he's going to do Love Johnson's voice. Can you get us a script? I'm like, Bruce? So basically, I have to quickly write a script. And then within 48 hours, they were friends with Bruce Campbell and he recorded Amazing. It. And then basically got back to it. I'm like, what the hell? Like, I've written a thing down. And I've given it to someone, and then Bruce Campbell's then voiced it. And like that was just mind blowing. But it never saw light of day. But someone did get in touch with me not so long ago and said, oh, ask me a few questions about it. And they've somehow got full playthroughs on YouTube of the games. And it all Bruce Campbell's voice acting's there. And there was an artist, and he was kind of fairly new. And I was like, right, what we're going to do is we're going to make it like a Flash Gordon serial. So we're going to jump in on chapter 7 and give you and basically had no budget. So there's no cutscene or anything like that. So, you know, like the kind of cards you'd get and go, you know, Flash Gordon previously in Flash Gordon, this happened and blah, blah, blah. So we made it all like that. That's very much lots of style. And this guy, Mignon, his name is very, very talented guy. He'd never heard of anything like this. And he created the artwork for it. And it's phenomenal. It's like amazing. He's like, is this good enough? Is this kind of thing you wanted? And it's like, yes, this is amazing. Can I get it's the best. And so they all went out there. So people who have seen it have like raved about it, and it was just good fun. It was just like explosions and fun stuff, and you know, it was good. But not many people have seen them, and even though everyone who's bought the game owns them, just locked away in this somewhere. But they are on YouTube. I found them.
Great that somebody unlocked it finally then, yeah, and got it.
I don't know who, what, how, why, but they do exist, and it brought me great joy to watch those. It was cool.
Well, there was also an Avengers game that you worked on that got cancelled with THQ.
Yes. So I went over to THQ and basically I had a good friend like a year previously. He's like, look, you've got to come over to THQ. There's a thing that's going to be awesome. You're going to love it. And I'd literally just got back from GDC to help sign these kind of projects. And I'm like, I can't, that's such a horrendous move. You know, it'd be awful. You know? Anyway, like a year later, unfortunately kind of Chrome went under and I applied to THQ and a lot of people went there. And what they'd done is I think they knew they wanted to do something risky, something that was going to be awesome. So they were doing this Avengers game that was going to tie in with the first Avengers movie. And they'd done it for, and I was like, Avengers game, another superhero game, but they'd done it in first person, which was a risky move. And it was amazing. So when I got there, they'd already had like kind of the basis of a game. And they knew it was going to be darker. It's going to be its own thing. So the reason it was darker, so it'd connect with like Call of Duty players, you know, so it's a bit grittier. And so I ended up, first of all, I was kind of like helping kind of prototype levels, but like more for storytelling, not for like tech. They nailed all that. It was an awesome level design team and artists are all kind of paired up and they were great. And it was things like you could fly and do these things, like these amazing superhero things. But playing a lot of like Quake mod and things like that, it's like, well, we want to make you feel superior. So it was things like having a door and some stairs. You go up the stairs on the scaffolding and go through a door, but you put like a giant window next to it. So as a player, you'd have to run up the stairs and through the door. But as the Hulk, you just leap straight up there and smash through the wall and smash through the window. And you're in, I feel like I'm cheating. you know, it's not a Hulk playground. It's a human-sized playground that Hulk can tear up, that kind of thing. And Thor can smash things. And it was essentially like Left 4 Dead. It was like Left 4 Dead, where it's all four of you. And then the enemies like Left 4 Dead would like basically take you down and you have to work as a team. So it doesn't matter what skill level you were, you know, just pick on someone. And it played a lot like Overwatch. So lots of abilities, but more like combos. So very simple controls, very chunky. And that was amazing. And then I got to kind of like, they had a base kind of plot, you know, what they wanted to do. So I got to write the story for that and do bits and bobs with that and then work with like Marvel writers. And because I wanted to, you know, again, like a playable story. And I remember sitting there thinking, like, if like 7-year-old me could look at me now, this would be amazing. You know, it was really, really cool. But I think when, you know, that was cancelled when like the whole of THQ kind of, you know, fell through. But the harsh thing about that was it was a team of like 120 people, I think, with like 20 being external. And I've never seen so many people sing off the same song sheet. It was like harmony. Like there was no fat, you know, it was just bam, all stuff all day. It was so much work. To me and the lead artist would be like in like 15 million meetings in the morning. And then in the afternoon we do like loads of work. And then and at night we get stuff done. But everyone poured their heart and souls into that. It was very, very cool. And it was really, really good. But yeah, I was really sad that we'd never see light of day because I think it's a cool story, you know, and all this extra content and the guys working on the characters, were amazing. But yeah, the biggest shame was that team got broken up and it was super efficient. Like it was good. You know, some people say that, you know, big teams aren't really good and small teams, and it's not, it doesn't matter to me. I've been on both. And it's communication and having very clear kind of rules and then, you know, letting people be creative and doing their own things. And that's what they did. And it was awesome. It was awesome to see.
I did see as well that a leaked build of that did arrive on the internet a couple of years ago. So people want to see kind of what, you know, an early build of it, what an Avengers FPS game would have looked like. That is on YouTube as well. So
yeah, it's very, very cool.
This kind of gets preserved. What are you doing these days though, Kev? I mean, are you still involved in the industry?
I am. So I'm currently what's classed as in between jobs. So I've got a few side projects, things like that, and a few things that I can't really talk about, but there's NDAs and things like that. But I just recently, I was out of the games industry for the first time ever, which was bizarre, which was weird because, you know, it's been 28 years, but I suppose the last two or three of those weren't doing games and I was doing stuff for like mental health and working with therapists and things like that. And it's all the kind of same game principles, you know, to get people, in, you know, engaged and things like that. So I was doing that. But now I'm going back into games again. So like I said, I've got a few things in the pipeline, but I can't say yet because nothing's concrete, but I'll be doing that. But yeah, it's just been bizarre this year that all these people have come back the woodwork and said, hey, do you want to talk about this old game from 20 years ago? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. So I think, yeah, it's like a calling back to the game industry. Yeah,
maybe there's a remaster on the table somewhere of one of these titles.
But everyone keeps saying it. I'm like, I don't know if I can remember everything. And again, I'm probably looking at things, so it's rose-tinted glasses. I'm like, oh, God, yeah. Like, I don't know, I've still got piles and piles of books and notes and things. And I can literally look through like a book and go, I remember this, you know, and all the systems that we've got and all the things that we've tried and things like that. But yeah, I suppose I'm always grateful, you know, because I've been very lucky in the game industry. And I think it's amazing that everyone wants to talk about things and people are interested. And it's like, oh, this is so bizarre to me. But yeah, it's very wholesome. And then in the world's kind of current climate, you know, like wholesomeness is good. You know, I'm very much enjoying it.
No, 100%. Well, Kev, we really appreciate you taking some time to share some of your memories of working on those huge games with us as well. And we'll keep our eyes peeled for what you're doing next when you can share what you're doing. So thanks very much for coming on the podcast and being our guest this week. It's been great to talk to you.
Thank you very much.